2020, baby.
Hello, and welcome to this New Year's edition of the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. If everything is going according to plan, you are listening to this during the final days of 2019, and none of us are anywhere near the 538 office or studio. But in this news environment, who knows? So yes, we are pre-recording this, and for the record, it's about a week into December. So today, we're going to spend half the show looking back at 2019 and taking stock of the most important political moments of the year. And in the second half, we're going to look ahead to 2020 and discuss our most pressing questions for the election year ahead. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going well, Galen.
If everything is going according to plan, where are you right now?
Seville, Spain, or maybe Cordoba, Spain.
Oh.
Eating some tapas, probably having some good wine.
Ay, qué rico.
When I went to Spain, I like literally didn't eat any fruit or vegetables for like 10 days.
It's almost set out on
we think about
days.
Europeans as being very like healthy. Not a lot of greens. Not a lot of greens. I actually crave greens when I come back from Europe.
I mean, I'm sure that like
what a relatable statement.
First world problems.
I'm enjoying my new Peloton that I got for... No, I'm just kidding.
Not too soon. Just the right timing. And senior politics writer Claire Malone, how's it going and where are you?
I'm in North America.
You're in North America. Okay.
It's going
cool.
Well.
Living
the life. I'm on the East Coast.
Hopefully preparing for a good New Year celebration.
Yeah. I'm going to get... Yeah. I'm gonna
get, What was that? Was that going to be a I'm going to get crunk? I think that's what I almost heard you say.
But I didn't.
I think you're not alone on that one. And also here with us is managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you and where are you?
I'd rather not say where I am right now, but I'm doing very well.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm not going to be anywhere exciting, but that way it sounds like.
Are you going to be on the East Coast as I am?
I will be on the East Coast, somewhere on the East Coast.
All right, fabulous. Let's begin by bringing ourselves back to this time last year. Claire, what were some key expectations that we had for how politics would play out in 2019 that didn't necessarily go as expected?
So I was thinking about this, just reflecting on my year and what I was doing last December was reporting a piece about the sort of upstart progressive left activists in the Democratic Party because we had just come off the midterm. The last 6 months had sort of been defined by the AOC rising star. And, you know, there was a lot of coverage at the end of 2018 and the first months of 2019 of what we now know as the Squad. And so I was kind of interested in the Overton window opening ideas that were percolating, you know, the idea that there were, you know, court packing and all that stuff. And this was sort of this is before anyone had run for president. Oh, what a halcyon time that was.
Hadn't John Delaney entered the race, Claire?
And Andrew Yang. Yeah.
All right. Fine, guys.
there was a
ton of talk about how much there were these progressive litmus tests for the primary. And so I think that has proven half true for 2019, right? There were a lot of progressive litmus tests, and a lot of the primary was around the litmus test of healthcare. But now at the end of 2019, you know, I'm looking at the top four candidates basically, and it's two moderates and it's two progressives. And it's interesting. And the people who are getting into the race, now I'm not saying they're going to be successful, but Deval Patrick and Michael Bloomberg see spaces in the moderate lane of things. And I think that's interesting, right? I think the conversation at the end of this year is not necessarily around, oh, the party is getting super left. It's about, ooh, the party isn't as left as you thought it was.
Micah and Nate, I'm curious if that was a big theme for 2019 in your view as well. The expectations going in is that it would be full of activists in the party driving the party left, and whether this kind of course correction seemingly towards the end of the year was a surprise.
I actually think it's very hard to like kind of place yourself in the mentality that you were a year ago. I mean, certainly the big story of 2018 politically was the Kavanaugh confirmation and then the midterms. And Democrats coming out of the midterms feeling pretty good. Although I think I clearly agree like maybe the big political story in the primary, which is probably the part we're most interested in is 538, is this shift toward the left kind of in the first half of the year and then a shift back to the center more recently. That seems like the big story there. You know, I mean, if, in terms of things that went wrong, I mean, if we were sitting here a year ago, we would have correctly identified some of the big Democratic candidates in the race, but we probably would have been much higher on Beto than he deserved in retrospect and Kamala Harris. So, you know, you already have a couple of casualties of high expectations.
I agree with all that. Look, very early on, actually, we were saying, don't forget there's a big chunk of the Democratic Party that is not super liberal. I've been surprised by how sort of like a tale of two halves it's been. It seemed like all the energy was on the left for like the first half of this primary, the first half of 2019. Then all of a sudden there was like the moderates bite back and it seemed like there was a reaction. The other thing I've been surprised by, which maybe we shouldn't have been, is just how much electability has dominated the conversation. I think we knew it would be a big subject of conversation, but just how much voters care about it, I didn't anticipate. And then the big one, I think, is impeachment. For obvious reasons, I don't think we saw impeachment as all that likely until the Ukraine thing happened.
In terms of the shift in Democrats' mentality or which side the energy is on, was there a clear turning point? I'm trying to think back over the year. Maybe the first debate sticks out to me as something where how far left the party had shifted became really clear and more moderate voices in the party started speaking up. But was there a clear shift?
I feel like it took longer. Like, yeah. I actually think Buttigieg is an interesting figure in all this because he is, to his strategic advantage, not a person who was well-known and thus well-defined by ideology. And I think he kind of entered the race and the national consciousness as people were talking about his sexual orientation. He kind of was gave vague plans, right, that sort of seemed to fall under more, okay, like progressive Medicare for All stuff. There wasn't a lot of actually like fine-tuning the policy stuff. And then there was a moment, which I think was only a few months ago, where he was kind of like, and his campaign was kind of like, ooh, you know, there's an opening in the middle, right? And I think Harris tried to split the baby a little bit and it didn't work, where she kind of tried to say, well, I'm not that progressive. But, you know, we talked about this, she was the compromise candidate. And I think Buttigieg found a nice way into that moderate space.
Yeah, I think Buttigieg captures it. I think it was really Warren's rise that
that's a good point.
That flipped that switch. Now, look, that switch is like
the summer, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's partly a media creation. It's partly like, what's the narrative? But on the other hand, something real did happen where you had Buttigieg make that pivot, and where Warren was climbing, all of a sudden it was like, wait a second, is she too liberal? And then she's been struggling more recently in the polls.
Yeah, I think one difficult thing about 2019 is like the key stories and the key memorable days or moments like don't actually correlate that well, right? So key moments, and I'm going to have a particular criteria for it, which is like the times when you feel like, oh my gosh, things are shifting and moving in real time.
You knew in real time.
Where you feel like, you know, I was in an earthquake in 2019 when I was in Las Vegas over the summer. You know, like literally there is like something seismic about like I kind of feel the ground shaking. And there are two moments like that.
That is what an earthquake is.
Were you in a casino?
I was at the World Series of Poker at the Rio All Suites Hotel and Casino.
Do you also crave greens when you get back from Vegas?
Vegas also got a lot of greens. Yeah, to be honest. I mean, I never thought I'd like greens that much, but like you go to freaking Europe or Vegas, and like there's no salad anywhere. Okay.
Oh my God, Nate, never change, man.
Anyway, so where was that earthquake-like activity? I thought, we'll talk about Trump more later, the day when like Trump released the transcript of the Ukraine call
yeah.
and the transcript was really bad, that was pretty seismic. We can talk about like whether that was an overreaction or not in real time. Clearly, the president's probably going to get impeached, right? So it's not like a minor thing exactly. But on the other hand, is he going to get removed from office? We'll talk about that later. Maybe not. The other one was that first debate where kind of all the candidates were, I think it's on different nights, right? On the first night, kind of all the candidates raising their hand, I forget who the exceptions were about, would we ban private insurance from healthcare, right? That was like saying, hey, we're going to the left. And then Kamala Harris attacking Joe Biden. Attacking feels like it's a loaded term, which I don't mean, right? But going after Joe Biden in a way that I thought was very effective. And she rose in the polls and it kind of looked like, okay, things are kind of finally now being shaken up. But in fact, she lost that bounce after a few weeks and had a lot of problems as we've discussed ad nauseum on this podcast, about Kamala Harris's campaign. In retrospect, though, like I said, that wasn't the most important moment. I think the moment was the one that you, Claire, and Micah were identifying a moment ago, which is this moment where Warren rises and is kind of deemed to be the national frontrunner or co-frontrunner, and then how quickly the backlash happens, right? How much these rich donors are like, well, we don't know about her. Maybe we need Michael Bloomberg or Deval Patrick or someone in the race, right? How much Buttigieg is able to say, okay, actually, well, now that she's a front runner, right, I can kind of run to her right. How much healthcare was a trap for her? I mean, the thing is, like, I also don't think the big moments were exactly surprising, but it does feel like inflection points where it would not have been crazy to imagine a world in which Warren rises and some combination of the following happens. Either some Sanders people come and say, okay, well, I like Bernie better, but Warren clearly can win, and with our support, she'll definitely win. And so AOC endorses Elizabeth Warren, and that sends a different trajectory. Or people in the establishment saying, you know what, clearly this is what the people want. She's a little bit more progressive than we might like, but hey, she's not Bernie, and she can be collegial, and we can work with her, and so let's elevate her instead of tearing her down. Now, to be fair, usually what happens when you get to be perceived as a front runner is that you get torn down, and we kind of only have like a few moments in history where a woman was perceived as a front runner in the presidential primary, and they're all associated with that woman having a tough time, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton, the kind of perpetual inevitable frontrunner in 2008, Hillary Clinton again in 2016, where she did win by some margin, but like clearly was not having an easy go of it. Warren at that moment this fall, and then maybe Harris kind of also that moment this summer. And so you're kind of four for four as like when a woman becomes the frontrunner.
Michelle Bachmann?
She did not quite have her moment in the sun.
She was up there.
Wasn't she a polling leader at one point?
Yeah.
I think she was the one who did not. But like when that happens, coincidence or not, right, then
there's
it seems like
scrutiny.
There's an especially strong.
So let's refocus on some of the key moments in 2019. You said your two, that first debate and then also the Ukraine scandal emerging, although some of the shifts in the Democratic primary did not actually coincide with those kind of seemingly ground-shifting moments. Claire, what were some of your key moments in 2019 that just stick out, whether or not they were surprising?
You know, the summer inflection point that Nate is talking about is certainly a shifting point, but he already covered that. I think the things like looking back, Biden deciding to run, I mean, it's kind of banal and on one level because people, oh, okay, of course he was going to run. But I don't think that was always inevitable. And so the fact that he has remained a flawed but steady front runner or co-front runner, however you want to say it, is interesting. And I think his decision to actually run is a big one, looking back.
Also, in some regard, instigated the Ukraine scandal, right? Because if he doesn't run, then...
Totally.
No Ukraine scandal.
And then I would... Yeah, exactly. And then I would say the other two things that stick out in my mind are the Mueller report, because it drove so much of A, Trump's psychology and thus the actions he took, and B, because it drove the party politics within the Democratic caucus, right? You know, that friction between the moderates and the progressives. It helped define that dynamic. And then, of course, I think, you know, the political event of the year is the Ukraine impeachment fracas. And it's funny that we have in a single year two tracks of impeachment. I mean, that's quite a thing.
Yeah.
But it's like in some ways I in my mind, maybe it's because I work at 538, I really do separate out the impeachment stuff versus the campaign, because I think they're different beasts and they have different end goals. And actually, impeachment doesn't necessarily like serve the best electoral masters for the Democrats. But I still think it's obviously a huge moment in the country. So those are my three. But I think it's been a crazy fall. The shift in the dynamic of the election plus the Ukraine stuff is just... It's been a lot.
Micah, I'm going to get to you in just a minute. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538. We're back, and I just want to pick up where we left off. Claire, you were just sharing your top three political moments of 2019. Micah, let's get to you. What were the defining moments of 2019 politically?
I think you guys named the main ones. I'll throw a couple lower level ones out in terms of the primary. One, and I'm just stealing this from Nate, I think the AOC endorsement of Bernie Sanders looking back was a big moment. I don't think I at the time appreciated how big a deal either technically and practically and literally it was or just symbolically. But it feels like Nate was getting at this, but that was an inflection point, and the Sanders campaign, the Warren campaign, and therefore Biden's chances could all look very different, and Buttigieg if that doesn't happen. And then going even farther back, the Buttigieg town hall was in 2019, I think.
Yeah, when we were preparing for this episode today, we were having trouble figuring out what happened in 2019.
I was having most of the trouble. I was like, Galen, was this in 2018 or 2019? But that kind of originally put Buttigieg on the map, and I think telegraphed that there was some appetite for his candidacy among voters and certainly an appetite for his candidacy among the media. The other one that I'll just kind of throw out there is the North Korea maneuvering summit that happened, if you remember. I don't think that really fits in with any broader narrative, but it just was a big moment.
I do want to add one more. The shutdown persisted.
That's a lame one.
It's not a lame one. It's better than other crap.
Wait, defend yourself.
It moved Trump's approval rating.
The shutdown moved Trump's approval rating. I mean, it was one
and
of those.
And then it moved back.
Answer the question.
He got you.
Answer
there,
the
Nate.
Question.
He got you
and
there.
And then it moved back.
That is a lame moment. You're just trying
these
to.
These are
like,
all lame moments.
Wait.
Like,
no,
wait.
It's
don't
not.
Just, don't what, just sack everyone's moment because you got one bad moment.
Yeah, you just wanted the last word.
I'm trying not to have hindsight bias here. I guess that's the point of this.
The whole
show.
Point is to have hindsight bias.
Literally a look back.
Everyone is enjoying the like holiday eggnog already, even though this is at the beginning of December that we're taping this. I mean, on the topic of Trump and
I've been drunk this whole month at work.
On the topic of Trump, Micah, you mentioned Trump being the first U.S. president to go to North Korea crossing the DMZ line when he met with Kim Jong-un. How did Trump's year compare with what our expectations might have been? And I don't want to be like a broken record in asking this question, but traditionally when a president's party does really poorly at the midterms, there's some kind of course correction. Either there is pressure from that president's party, people in Congress to maybe moderate a little bit or try different policies. Did we actually expect that to happen going into this year? And was there any of that?
I remember Nate talking a lot that he expected a pivot to the center, but here's a hot take. I think Trump's 2019 played out almost exactly as we expected it to play out.
Ukraine scandal included?
The particulars we did not and could not anticipate, but the level of chaos, the self-harm done politically, the craziness of it all, I think we all anticipated, didn't we?
I mean, on a scale of like people, because the thing is, people are always like, so much crazy stuff happened in 2019.
But it did.
I think 2019 was like on the scale of predictable to unpredictable on the predictable side.
Isn't that kind of what Micah just said?
Yeah, he's agreeing with
you. I'm agreeing with you.
But Nate, it was predictably crazy. It was still crazy.
But you guys agree and you're yelling at each other.
Claire, let me finish.
In 10 years, do you think politics will be back to normal and we'll be like, God, this is so dull? Or do you think it'll be this
by 10 years?
And no one will listen to this podcast anymore because it's just, well, there was a meeting, NATO meeting.
Are we
meeting,
still going to be doing this podcast in 10 years?
We're all hunched over with canes.
In 10 years?
Isn't that how the media works? In 10 years, I mean...
In 10 years, I'll be unemployable.
I'll be unemployable.
I think at some point, there will be a, is politics boring now, media narrative. But I think, shouldn't we rate the biggest moments? Shouldn't we rank them in order?
Can I add one more to the mix before we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I guess, my own personal coverage bias. Gerrymandering made its way to the Supreme Court. And actually, the courts in general, I think... We, when we look back at the year, can focus on political moments that don't necessarily have any bearing long term on the course of the country, like the shutdown, for example, whereas Supreme Court decisions do, right? They create new precedents and they either open doors to future litigation or close doors to future litigation. And gerrymandering reaching the Supreme Court and the court deciding that it's not up to the court to decide as an issue, I think was interesting, and we'll see the repercussions of that in 2020, 2021.
Again, so I want to tell people listening at home or on your commute or if you're in a casino.
Nate, this whole podcast is us telling
people. Or in Spain eating food that doesn't involve salad. I want you to remember this is not our assessment of like which moments will matter the most going forward, because the gerrymandering decision and the court in general is a lot more important than a lot of things that we're talking about here.
Okay, here's my biggest political moments of 2019. This is heavily weighted towards the Democratic primary, but includes non-primary stuff. Number one, Ukraine. Number two, some healthcare thing. Number three, number three, release of the Mueller report. Number four, North Korea summit. Five, Biden entering the race. Six, AOC endorsement of Sanders. Seven, Buttigieg town hall. Eight, that Supreme Court. Galen mentioned 9, some Green New Deal or something.
Take North Korea off the list, because even though we could all still die in a nuclear holocaust, I think that it won't be this year.
Okay, so North Korea goes to the end. Galen, you
that
made
was a hot take from Claire.
And if we have died in holocaust,
if you're listening,
you are not
to this,
listening.
Galen, you made a face at AOC endorsement.
Does Heaven have podcasts?
You think that should be lower?
AOC endorsement seems to signify Sanders' strength overall, and I think Sanders' strength overall is just more important. The 15% that was going to be for him got behind him and have stuck with him.
Should that
and
be
they didn't switch to Elizabeth Warren.
Should that be above or below the Buttigieg town hall?
Below.
I'm looking at Micah's rankings right now. Okay, here's what it is. Pure politics, it's Ukraine and healthcare. I think those first two are right. I think it should be 3, Biden entering the race, 4, release of the Mueller report, 5, Buttigieg town hall, 6, Supreme Court stuff, and then I'm knocking the rest off the list entirely. The Green New Deal? Who knows what that is? AOC endorsing Sanders? Galen made the point already. And North Korea, to my further point of, we're not all dying this year. I mean, I hope.
So you just have 5?
Just five.
Yeah, this is a weird... It's like when...
The Buttigieg town hall seems too high for some reason.
Yeah.
But
we need a Buttigieg
thing.
Yeah. I think healthcare includes and encapsulates
that.
Warren.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Warren
okay.
and Buttigieg.
Warren
number
rise
one,
and
the
backlash.
Primary. Number two, the White House. Those are my two big moments.
Number three, the judicial branch.
The judicial branch. Number four, war. Number five, famine.
Famine isn't funny.
First of all.
Peace on earth, goodwill to men.
Nate, was that an implicit criticism of this list?
Yes, explicit.
I mean, honestly, like Hong Kong still ongoing is a fascinating moment, if you will, and like
the war in Yemen.
Yep,
guys, I don't appreciate the. Let's all talk about serious subjects all of a sudden.
So, what's the takeaway here?
This is a circular conversation where we're all like, it was busy.
Here's the bow on it is the official 538 list, Nate Silver's 538, biggest political moments of 2019. Ukraine, healthcare.
This is not my list.
Biden entering the race.
This is not my list.
Release of the Mueller report, Buttigieg town hall. Done.
The Buttigieg town hall is like a really... It feels like a really big step from like the release of the Mueller report. Buttigieg just CNN town
congrats
hall.
To CNN for making our CNN. List.
Maybe the Mueller report is in the category of like, it's not a non-event, but there certainly were some political climaxes that people might have been expecting that didn't occur in 2019.
Ooh, who's the most overrated political character of 2019? I'm going to go hot take, Robert Mueller.
Ooh.
I mean, let's not get too hindsight biasy about Beto. I think you were more skeptical, and I don't think we were like super. But like Beto symbolized like this good.
I was skeptical.
Claire was very skeptical.
I'd like to say I was skeptical of Beto before it was cool.
Is it actually an award?
This is a 538 award.
Give it to Beto. Come on. The guy
Beto gets one.
Oh, Nancy Pelosi. Overrated, underrated, properly rated.
Underrated.
That's what everyone says, though. So doesn't that make her overrated?
Mm-hmm. Even accounting for that. Okay. Underrated.
She's had a good year. You know, she let everyone take shots at her during the midterms, whatever you need to do to win. And then, man, 2019 has really been like a year between like the impeachment stuff, but also like Pelosi's White House interactions with Trump have been something else.
Yeah.
Like, that's been really interesting to me.
Oh, wait. We didn't mention, actually, that 2019 started with a record number of women being sworn into the House. That's kind of a significant moment of 2019. I saw the stat that the number of women in the House quadrupled between when Nancy Pelosi first entered and now.
I think we should point out that it is still an incredibly small number. Yeah. So I'm kind of, I think that's like that statistic is both an interesting one and sort of a shaming one, right? Because it was the year of the woman, but more like multiples more women were elected, but it's still.
How about that? How about
not that one? Particularly in the Republican caucus, right? Which we've written about.
Which we've written about. It's easy to quadruple a really low number.
But the year of the woman ending in this primary field, where as of December 6th, three of the four leading candidates are like white men. Three of the four are older 70. All four are white. I mean, that seems like significant. Maybe that ties into electability. Maybe Harris and Booker got unlucky. Maybe by the time you're listening to this, Booker or Castro or Deval Patrick has surged.
Don't you think we have like a post-holidays, I've talked with my family. Don't you think we have one more person who drops out before the caucuses?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Couple. How many what do you think our January is looking like? Who's dropping out? Or how many dropouts do you think people should expect?
I wouldn't think many, actually.
I mean, I guess some of the people remaining don't have a big enough campaign structure running that they would need to drop out just because of cash.
Would Klobuchar drop out before Iowa?
No.
Because Andrew Yang is in.
Andrew Yang, no.
Bernie Sanders is in. Booker?
No.
Sure.
Yeah, I think he's a candidate to drop out. Castro is a candidate to drop out.
Deval Patrick?
I mean, Patrick could drop right back out.
Warren, Biden, Bloomberg. No.
If Bloomberg is still at 4% in 2 weeks, I wouldn't be surprised if you're listening to this and Michael Bloomberg has dropped out. And I am right now snarkily tweeting something about like people once again over to the importance of paid advertising and politics, sipping my Rioja.
Well, and with that, let's move on to our look ahead to 2019. Sorry.
2020, baby. The definitional year.
But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Upstart. Applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, loan companies make their decisions based off your credit score and history without getting to know the whole you. Now, thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and education in the form of a smarter interest rate. Unlike traditional credit underwriting, which could be biased against people with a short credit history, Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. Over 100,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, or to make a large purchase. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/politics. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538. We're back, and looking ahead to 2020, I'm going to lay out some of the biggest unknowns of the year at this point, and I'm interested in hearing how unknown those things actually are. Do we have a good sense of how they will play out, and whether or not they'll matter in determining who goes on to win the 2020 election? So let's just get this out of the way. I kind of think I know the answer, but let's begin with impeachment. How big of an unknown is that, and how much does it matter for 2020?
It's not that big of an unknown. It's a
known known.
Should we pull up the Rumsfeld rubric?
The Rumsfeldian. It's a known known.
It's a known known. He'll be impeached.
And not removed.
And not removed.
And won't matter that much? Question mark?
Question mark, question mark.
Exclamation point.
I'm not willing to go that far.
Depends it could, how it plays
could,
out.
Yeah, it could like win people. It could make a difference at the margins. It could win people over. It could piss people off.
I mean, our polling finds there are a few voters who think Trump's conduct is impeachable, but that he shouldn't be impeached. And I don't know what those voters do. I don't know if those voters say, you know what, he didn't need to be impeached because we can vote him out of office ourselves. Or if they say, you know what, it's not great, but Democrats went too far. So therefore, you know.
Well, or there's a third bucket, which is they're like, oh, we shouldn't impeach because we can vote him out of office. But by the time the election comes around, impeachment is a distant memory and it's all pretty far gone.
All right. Next up, who will the Democratic nominee be? How much of an unknown is that?
Well, look, I think if you narrow it down to a few people, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Michael Bloomberg,
If you're following along, it's a known unknown.
It's on the unsettled side as far as primaries go. If you kind of classify primaries into two big buckets, right, kind of follow the leader races like Hillary in 08 or 16 versus unsettled races, this is on the unsettled side of the spectrum, although Biden has actually maintained kind of a Mitt Romney 2012 type of lead.
It's unsettled in the sense that there's still many candidates still have a real chance of winning, not in the sense that there's been a ton of movement, right?
I mean, there has been some, but not a ton.
There's basically four candidates who, like, I think I'll speak for all of us in this room and say, like, we wouldn't be surprised if any of those four won the primary. But I personally cannot say which one I think has the best chance right now.
I think Biden has the best chance.
By the way, those candidates being Biden, Buttigieg, Warren, and Sanders.
But I think that's exactly. I do think Biden has the best chance, but I would not be surprised by any of those candidates winning the nomination.
Or
Klobuchar?
Or from the
or
field?
Or TBD, yeah. Or a field. I mean, I would almost kind of say, okay, this is dangerously in the realm of probabilities, right?
Don't go there.
Take the top four.
Sounds dangerous.
Give them one unit of chance each. Give the field.
One unit.
One unit. And then give Biden a second unit. Like, that's probably not, and you can do the math at home, right? By this time, our model may or may not have been published.
It will be.
In which case,
it will be up.
Hopefully.
Oh, God.
But, you know, but like, if you want to know the pre-model opinion, that's kind of my rough heuristic.
So here's the question, though. How much does it matter in terms of the general election?
Who the nominee is?
Mm-hmm.
Quite a bit, I think. Because I think Democratic strategists are definitely looking at the polling in the swing states, right? And they're saying, listen, some of these nominees play very differently than others. And this is stuff that people have been saying for a while, right? Which is like, if you want to win those traditional blue wall states, go for a moderate. And if you nominate a Sanders or a Warren, I think you have to get a little more, not creative. It would have to be, in order for the Democrats to win, it would have to be an election. And this is not out of the realm of the possible at all. But you just have to, like, assume it's going to be a year where a new map is forged in some level.
When we talk about how much the nominee matters, what is the range we're talking about? Is it, like, 1% to 3% or 3% to 5% in terms of how much the nominee can change the end result.
In vote share or win probability?
In vote share.
I actually think win probability is easier to get your head around, but this is a very hard question to answer. I think people overrate how much of a difference it makes. Look, in our polling we did with Ipsos, so here were the ranges that people gave each candidate their chances of beating Trump, right? It ranged from an average of 27% for Tom Steyer to 68% for Joe Biden, right? On average. That's a really wide range. You're essentially talking about someone going, one nominee is a clear underdog, one nominee is a clear favorite. I think the range is narrower than that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I mean, can we get any more specific than less than 40
points?
You
never really have a pure test because you only have one kind of race at a time, right? Yeah. We know if you look at races for Congress, then the nominee can make quite a lot of difference. However, like the selection process for Congress or Senate, which is a branch of Congress, in theory should filter out some of the more disastrous nominees. Sometimes an alleged child molester wins in Alabama anyway, but not very often do you have something like that happen. So like whoever the Democratic nominee is someone who will have survived
right.
the process, a process that contains a lot of checks and balances, including, importantly, the ability for the party to have the superdelegates decide, after all, with the other delegates if it goes to a contested convention, right? So the world, when you're listening to this in December 2020, and Elizabeth Warren became the nominee, she must have done something relatively well once the new year started to become the nominee, right? If you just randomly pick someone without that vetting process, then you might have nominees who are big disasters.
But I mean, Donald Trump won the Republican nomination in 2016. Many people predicted that he was sort of so far off the standard for a nominee that he would have this big effect on the general election. And he had an effect, I think.
I actually don't think it's that persuasive because there's not really any way to prove. I mean, Hillary Clinton, if you kind of look at her favorability ratings, might have lost to a generic Republican by 6 points or something, right? And that's
okay,
a pretty big swing.
Okay, that swing I wouldn't call that big. You know, that's a
okay,
single digits.
You told the average Democratic voter that whatever else candidate A would get against Trump, candidate B will get 4 points less. I mean, that Democrat would panic, I think.
So I think actually we're probably going to be talking about this exact conversation plenty, you know, at the start of 2020. So we can save some of this, but let's run through maybe a little more quickly the other questions that will be decided in 2020. And you mentioned this one, Nate, already, but what are the chances of a contested convention at this point?
Okay, Gail. Our model says, boop, 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 boop. That was our model speaking.
Late at night, Nate's computer talks to him.
I do get weird with this. Is so dorky. I'm not going to talk about it. Okay. No, but like I get weird with like variable names, right? Like I get really hungry. So I had to arbitrarily pick a name for a variable. So like named after a type of ramen.
What's the variable name?
Spicy Python. I need a memorable variable name.
I think that's good.
I was hungry. Don't code when you're hungry.
Can you code drunk?
I used to be able to, but like not really anymore. Sucks.
Yeah.
Getting old.
Yeah. So the way the model looks at it is, what's the chance no one wins a majority? And like that number is published. You can go look up what it is. We evidently put a lot of time and thought into that number.
We evidently.
Evidently. But that's not the same thing as a contested convention, right? Yep. If Joe Biden wins 47.5% of the delegates and, you know, and Bernie is next with 14 and Buttigieg is 13 and Castro has 12, right? Joe Biden is going to become the Democratic nominee and it'll probably happen well before the convention. It may even be kind of deemed inevitable by the media at some point, right?
Answer the question, Nate.
I have no idea. It's so I'm not going to give you like
answer
when I'm like actually working on a more rigorous way to provide this answer, which is a hard problem to solve.
And just to wrap up the conversation about a contested convention more broadly, does having a fraught primary process that I guess a contested convention would imply make it harder for that party to win?
Well, I guess Trump is
evidence to the contrary.
I don't know. I mean, I've thought that that the healthcare debate that the Democrats have felt that they needed to have in this primary in order to differentiate themselves from each other isn't necessarily the greatest thing for them in the general, right? Which I think, you know, let's say Warren realized and adjusted somewhat. I think that has to do – I think, you know, Trump came out of a really contested primary, a nasty one. I mean, that convention, while not contested, was not super harmonious, shall we say. When you were, like, in the room, you know, there were a lot of people who weren't happy he was the nominee. Maybe the Democrats are more likely to – because of, like, structural differences, because of the Electoral College, because of maybe – Republican advantages as far as vote efficiency goes, maybe Democrats are more likely to face challenges in a general election after having a nasty primary. I don't know. I mean, that's kind of – I think that's an educated theory, but it's not one I'm like in the middle of writing a 2,500-word piece about or something, so I can't.
My default is to be pretty skeptical of takes that, you know, a divisive primary or a hard-fought primary results in lessening that nominee's chances of winning the general election. That said, when you have a candidate who has really loyal supporters like Sanders in 2016, there were some analyses that found there were a meaningful amount of Sanders supporters who did not vote for Hillary Clinton, either voted for a third party, didn't vote, even voted for Trump. So it's something to watch. But look, like, you can absolutely win a general election after going through like a slug it out primary. See Barack Obama, right?
Okay, so moving on from the convention, I think this is something, again, we're going to talk about a lot in 2020. But just to give people a benchmark, how will the economy fare? At this point, how unknown is that and how much does it matter?
If I knew, you think I'd be here right now?
Well, probably. I mean, we do have the most current data, and it's not like we're trying to forecast years in advance, but, you know.
What's the, Nate, what are the bounds on how the economy could be doing, up or lower?
It could be anywhere from pretty f***ing good to really f***ing terrible, Micah. Those are the bounds.
Yeah.
Like, so like, unknown,
like
unknown.
Unknown, unknown.
No, unknown. We know.
No, it's an unknown, because it's a thing that we don't know. We don't know.
I mean, at this point,
we do know. We don't know it.
No,
Claire.
No, you don't know that. Are you saying like the economy will exist next year? Yes. Then it's a known unknown.
We know. We have written articles about how it's very hard to predict with any exactness how the economy is doing a year from now.
Do you remember something called the financial crisis?
And this is where
were they on Full House?
In December 2007, the Federal Reserve assigned only a 9% chance of a recession. Turned out we got the second worst recession of all time. So, like, that tells you something, right?
This is really random, but did you guys have Fed Challenge at your high school?
No.
Okay, what is that?
Fed Challenge
is it like mock trial, but for
yes,
the Fed?
Yes, for the Fed.
What?
Oh my God.
Yes. The team at my high school was like really good, and
wait, do you like decide on interest rates?
And, yes, and they like, and I graduated from high school in 2005, so this is pre-crash. We graduated from college the year of the crash, but our team was super good. They like missed prom to be in it and stuff, and then like the financial crash happened.
Sorry, I would love to, but I've got Fed Challenge that week.
No, actually, and then. I was talking about this with people recently because it's like, man, all those kids like got into college basically on their like, we're super good at the Fed Challenge. And then the crash happened 4 years ago and everyone was like, just forget everything.
If they had gone to prom. They would have read social cues more accurately. Is this like the point in the podcast where you wonder if like you forgot to turn the podcast off because it's still going?
Okay. Our last question in 2020 is, which do you want it to be? Political scandals, most surprising headline, or who ran the better campaign?
Scandals.
Okay. Will there be any big political scandals or October surprises in 2020?
Ding, 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 ding.
All right,
yes.
Claire.
Yes.
What's the answer?
This is an unknown unknown, but like in our world, it's basically a known unknown. Yes, Galen, there will be an October surprise.
What's the most boring possible 2020?
Scandal.
It's like Biden winning By a solid
The October surprise would be someone dying, right?
Oh my God.
Oh my God, Claire.
Wait, you got should I not say that?
No, you're right.
But I'm serious.
That is dark.
No, think about it. It's like
you're the oldest
field of candidates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All around. The three should I really not say that? But it's true.
It is true. Jeez.
I mean, that's a movie right there. We shouldn't put it in the podcast so that you can sell
it
to Hollywood.
Pitch a movie.
Wait, what happens? Like what happens?
VP takes over, right? Or does the party get to renominate somebody?
That's my question. Is if one of the party's nominees dies in October?
I think what would happen is that you would vote for that person in absentia, and that would represent the Democratic Party's
because the ballot would have closed presumably.
I mean, it would be a mess.
It would be a mess. Elections experts, please write in and tell us.
At Claire Maloney.
And also, you know, script readers who are interested in purchasing that.
Yeah, guys, I'm ready to make a movie. I got lots of ideas.
It would not be... never mind.
What?
Whisper it.
No,
they won't hear.
Do you think there'll be another Trump scandal in 2020?
Yes.
Oh, wait. Here's one thing.
Let's say
financial, sex, or
child separation magnitude scandal.
Oh, you mean a specific policy?
I don't know if people
kind
call
of
a scandal.
Yeah, that was a policy, not a scandal. I mean,
it was scandalous.
I agree, but it was not a scandal classically defined.
I just mean a scandal that reaches the level of sort of media coverage, awareness as child separation.
I think that seems very likely.
From a practical perspective, the Democratic Party has known who the Republican nominee in 2020 would be.
Who is it?
For like 4 years and has been doing Oppo research for 4 years. Maybe they got the NBC tapes. I am sure, I don't know this for a fact, I don't have any sources on this, I imagine that the Democratic Party has been stockpiling dirt on the president for 3 years so far and will continue to do so through 2020, and we will see the fruits of that.
I think it's more likely, actually. I mean, that's true, but I think it's more likely that a big political scandal will come from something new that Trump does.
What is it going to be?
I don't know.
I think the categories are financial, sexual, and question mark because
will we see Trump's tax returns?
Abuse of power, I guess. I'd give that a decent chance.
All right. And with that, there are other unknowns of 2020, but you'll have to stick with us throughout the coming year to find out what they are and how much they matter.
It's going
to
be a banger.
It's going to be a banger. Stick with us and tell your friends about us.
Tell your friends we resolved to do better in 2020.
If you know, there was too much eggnog in 2019. We were great. If you know anyone who is in Fed Challenge or is currently in Fed Challenge, they will definitely like this show. So,
Claire, we're not always drunk on eggnog when we're recording. So, you know, if we get serious sometimes.
Targeting the Fed Challenge crew is not the most effective audience
development strategy. They're already listening. Who are we kidding?
They're also like, how many of them? 10?
What groups in high school do we want to target?
The jocks.
All of them.
Yeah.
How about musical theater?
The jocks?
Yeah, we want them.
Theater.
We want everyone. The slackers.
The slackers.
The
cheerleaders. The skaters.
The stoners. The sexually active band nerds.
People who eat lunch in bathroom stalls.
What is that?
You haven't seen Mean Girls?
Oh, yeah.
No one does that, though.
I don't think people actually do that.
What new listeners?
This what new great. High school typologies are there?
Have you guys
that didn't used to be around when we were kids?
Have you guys seen the remake of 21 Jump Street?
Yes, I was just about to bring this up.
It's such a good scene.
It's like the cool kids in the modern high school are like climate change
super
activists.
Super eco-conscious.
Super friendly,
studious.
Non-bullying, like studious people.
So they go back to high school and they act as if it was like, you know, the 90s or the 80s or whatever. And now like doing your homework is cool.
I love Channing Tatum.
It's such a funny scene.
It's so funny. It's really good.
Okay, so art challenge for everyone listening to this podcast. You're still on vacation, presumably, maybe, over the coming week. We want to see a diagram of the current cliques in American high school that Gen Z... Is it still Gen Z in high school? I assume it's still Gen Z in high school right now.
It's Gen AA now.
A diagram
from doing
of the,
the diagram, a diagram of the cliques in high school. All right, we're gonna leave it there, guys. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
This is a mess, but great way. In a great way.
Thank you, Micah.
Happy New Year to you all. It was a wonderful spending 2019 with you.
Happy New Year. Thank you for sticking with us through 2019. Stick with us through 2020. And again, tell your high school friends about us. Unless there are any emergency circumstances, this is our only podcast plan for this week. We will be back with you live next Monday, and then it's off to the races of the Democratic primary race, and unless there's been some wild turn of events since the beginning of December, a trial of President Trump in the Senate. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store. Or again, tell someone about us.
You can leave
and
both.
Or review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.